Living simply, living local, living better.
The things which are good for the planet are also good for people. We thrive when we restore and protect the planet. And so plenitude is a word that I hope conveys that idea.
That's economist Juliet Shore. We'll talk to her about her book, Plenitude, and what it can tell us about living well within our means.
A mill on the edge of town with a parking lot full of cars from people shopping at Chatham Marketplace is actually energetically a good thing for this town. And the notion of, well, I'm going to drive on by and save my money down at Walmart might not really be in your best interest.
And that's entrepreneur and author Lyle Estill. He tells us about his book, Small is Possible, Life in a Local Economy. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Here are three predictions Juliet Shore makes about our economy if we keep on with business as usual. The economy will give us less income, more expensive goods, and lower life satisfaction. Unemployment will stay high, and the climate and ecological crises will mean that we can't just grow our way out of our economic problems. So are the good times over? Do we have to hunker down in our cold little caves and try to protect the little that's left? Or do we just have to shift our frame, put quality of life ahead of quantity of goods, and join our neighbors in enjoying a new definition of abundance? Juliet Shore has been writing about the downside of excess ever since her books The Overworked American and The Overspent American. Now she's turned her attention to the other side of the coin, how to live well within our means, not just financially, but also emotionally and ecologically. She says we have to shift out of our work and spend cycle, diversify our income, grow our own food, barter with our neighbors, and enter into richer relationships with our families and our communities. Shore's book, Plenitude, points the way to doing that. I spoke with Juliet Shore this summer. Juliet Shore, welcome to Writer's Voice. Plenitude. First, tell us, what do you mean by that?
I chose that word, which means abundance, and it's, you know, intended to convey the idea that we can have rich lives. In order to counter the dominant economic discourse, which is one that says, if you want to protect the planet, you've got to give something up. You have to suffer in order to do well by the planet. And that's the kind of trade-off mentality which dominates modern economics, the idea that we are always at a place in which there's no way to get better on one dimension without having to give up on the other. And I think it's the wrong mentality for understanding the way our society is organized, the way our economy is organized, and particularly when it comes to the planet, because actually the things which are good for the planet are also good for people. We thrive when we restore and protect the planet. And that's, I think, a fundamentally much better place from which to start. And so plenitude is a word that I hope conveys that idea.
You go right after this critique. What is the problem with the trade-off economics? Why is it wrong?
There are two parts of it. One is the really profound part, because it conceptualizes the environment as if it were another consumer good, like furniture or, you know, tennis rackets, and says, well, if you want more environment, you have to have less furniture and so forth. And, of course, there's an intuitive idea appeal there, which, you know, people think, well, yes, that's right. Cut down fewer trees, then we'd have fewer tables and chairs. But the far more important role of the planetary environment or ecology is as the support system for life and for the economy. So we can't just decide not to protect nature. We can't just degrade nature in the way that we have been doing, because that undermines our ability to make furniture. It undermines our capacity to live. And in fact, the protection of nature is what makes furniture possible. That's the first point. We are actually in the realm or in the zone now where we are using nature in ways that are very dangerous and disruptive and destabilizing to the climate, which are undermining the capacity of human beings to reproduce themselves in anything like the kind of way we currently know it. So the other smaller point about this is that the trade-off view, even if it were right, only pertains in situations where all resources are fully employed. And we happen to be at a moment when that is, you know, as far from being true as it has been since the 1930s. We have 26 million people in this country underemployed, unemployed, or out of work. So we have massive market failure, and the smartest thing that we could do right now would be to direct those people and to direct our energy and to use our tax dollars not to bail out corrupt banks and corrupt oil companies, but to use our collective wealth to invest in research, development, and diffusion of clean technologies, which on the one hand will get us new technologies that don't yet exist and also will bring down the prices of that alternative energy. The idea that alternative energy will be more expensive than fossil fuels over the, you know, any reasonable longer term horizon, I think is wrong. Fossil fuels are going to get a lot more expensive, particularly once we start counting in their true costs. And alternative energy is going to get cheaper and cheaper.
And by those true costs, you mean that destruction of the ecosystem that supports us?
That's one. There's another one, too. Well, there are others, but think about all of the money. We're spending over $1 trillion this year on the U.S. military. The most important thing that the U.S. military does today is it ensures American access to oil in other countries. If you look at where our bases are, where our activity is, and so forth, it's very much clustered around oil. And that policy, you know, has been going since about the 1930s, but actually in the late 1970s, after the oil crisis and the OPEC, you know, shutting off supplies, U.S. military policy went very strongly in the direction of protecting oil sources and supplies. The military burden of securing access to oil supplies around the world is a very large one, and that has to be factored in. We also can factor in other costs like asthma and health costs of polluted air, because these fossil fuels, particularly coal, which is extremely dirty fuel, oil is quite dirty, these fuels not only destabilize the climate, they also undermine human health. That's another great example of how what hurts people also hurts the planet. It's a noxious way to fuel an energy system, and the sooner we get off it, the better.
Now, you say that the route to lower impact doesn't require a hair shirt. You're saying here that we can, in a way, have our cake and eat it too. It seems to me as if that you're talking about two different kinds of growth in a way, because there's sometimes in your book, Plenitude, Juliet Shore, you talk about a kind of growth, as you just have, you know, a growth in green jobs. But you also say that there are some limits to that as well. In other words, it seems to be that there's good growth and bad growth.
Right. The growth is a vague word in certain ways, or it's a comprehensive word, so we want to specify exactly what we're talking about growing. So I want to distinguish, if we talk about what's good to grow, we want to distinguish that, say, for example, from the GDP, which is the official measure of output, and that's normally what we talk about if we're thinking of economic growth, it's the growth in GDP. That is a very problematic measure, which only counts some things and not others. In the case of the oil spill, it's going to count the cleanup efforts as part of the GDP, but it's not going to count the destruction of the ocean ecosystems as a result of this spill. So it's a flawed measure. We do need to increase certain things, and that will lead to growth in measured economic output, including in GDP. So we need more clean energy technologies. We need shifting to non-toxic ways of doing things, new production technologies in manufacturing and so forth. What this means for overall GDP is another question. I mean, I think that it will be pretty difficult to get us to the kinds of CO2 emissions, for example, that we need with a good climate strategy over the next four decades if we continually increase the scale of economic activity. There are things we can do that don't contribute much to degrading the earth. So, for example, local economic activity has much less footprint than purchasing goods which are produced far away. We can get involved in a sort of something, activities outside the market. A lot of my book is about that. It's about the notion of self-providing, doing and making things for oneself. If you grow food in your own garden, it's going to have a lower footprint than if you buy from an industrialized agriculture system where some of it might be coming from far-flung places. The same is true if you build a home from locally available, ecologically friendly materials versus buying the cookie-cutter house in a development built by a typical housing development company. I mean, the amount of CO2 footprint as well as other kind of ecological footprint associated with the construction industry in this country is enormous. It's something that people tend not to think of. It's an extremely wasteful industry. So, you know, we need to increase that kind of low footprint local economic activity. A lot of it's going to happen outside the formal market. It's already beginning to, because people's access to that, to the formal market, has been curtailed as a result of the, you know, what people call the Great Recession.
Talk a little bit more about that. I mean, on the one hand, we've had a pretty drastic reduction in output and, in fact, a decrease in greenhouse gas emissions as a result of that. But that's not really much of a solution, is it?
No, it isn't. And, you know, it's a very painful way to go, and it wasn't done in order to reduce eco-footprint, although the one thing we do know, looking at the data from around the world, is the only places that do manage to have, so far, have managed to have significant reductions in carbon footprint are the ones that, the economies that collapse. So the question is how we recover out of this recession and economic downturn in a way that doesn't just put us back on, you know, what I call the business-as-usual economy, but a path to ecocide and to further climate destabilization. There are a couple different parts of that. I mean, one part has to do with the fact that we have a lot of people who are unemployed and underemployed who don't have access to good jobs that give them decent livelihoods, and I think that's going to be the case for a long time going forward, not because I like it. I mean, I believe very strongly that the society should mobilize to make work available on an equitable basis, you know, to everyone who wants it. But I don't see that happening. I see the unemployment crisis as one which people are not going to be, politicians, business, economists are not paying nearly enough attention to, and I don't think there's going to be much in the way of attempt to solve it. So people are going to have to get, you know, somewhat more self-reliant in this, and I think come together and try and solve unemployment in the absence of a concerted government effort to do that. One of the things we need to do is share the work that we do have. If you look at what's happened in the market economy over the last 30 years, hours of work have increased pretty dramatically. That makes it so much harder to put people back to work because every job requires so much more revenue to be generated to get that higher number of hours. We work, you know, about 350 more hours on average than the average German worker. So if we have people who have jobs start to work shorter hours in the market over time, that frees up more work for people who are unemployed, and both groups start to do more self-providing, more coming together in locales to share things with each other, to trade with each other, to barter, to time bank, to produce things together, whether it's community vegetable gardening, or I talk in the book about something called fabrication laboratories, which are collections of small-scale machines that allow people to make things, manufactured goods. They're computer-driven. They were, this concept of a fab lab came out of MIT, but now there are fab labs around the world that are particularly useful for people who don't have access to a lot of cash, because you can make stuff with these fabrication technologies. You can make almost anything, almost any kind of manufactured good, even prefab houses, using computer instructions and often scrap plastics, metal, and so forth. So there are opportunities there to meet needs in ways that don't require reliance on the formal market.
You just said that we could all work fewer hours, and yet one reason the companies say that they are laying off employees is because they don't want to provide benefits, for example, health benefits, which are very expensive, to more employees. So they want to get more work out of each employee so that they have to pay fewer benefits overall. You have a solution for that problem, and it's going to take a solution on a policy level, a government policy level. Well, how can you make that kind of work reduction more affordable?
Yeah, well, the problem of high benefits costs, which are levied on a per person rather than a per hour basis, is at the core of why it is that in this country we've had a shift to growing hours of work, and that's something I talked about in my book, The Overworked American, 20 years ago. There are a number of different ways to get around that. You can prorate benefits by the hour. You can have the government take a bigger role in health insurance, for example. A single-payer system would eliminate this huge dysfunction, this huge sort of bias in the way the labor market operates. And it's interesting because people don't usually think of things in this way, but the system of financing healthcare in this country has had a profound impact on the amount of unemployment we have, and that's been it's had a growing impact over the years as health insurance has gotten more expensive. So that's one of the ways we can do it. The new healthcare bill doesn't really solve this, but it takes us a step farther in that direction. Particularly, you know, where you have cases of people being able to get access to health insurance at relatively low costs, which frees them up from dependence on jobs they don't necessarily want to be in or jobs which require too many hours, that's a real step forward. We've got a lot of people in this country who've held on to their jobs just because of the insurance. And so anything which frees them up from that dependence gives them more choice in terms of the kinds of work that they do, that's a really positive thing.
And we're talking with Juliet Shore about her new book, Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. So now connect the dots for us. Why would working fewer hours lead to a greener economy?
So there are a couple parts to this. One of them has to do with the fact that over time, if you think about the path of shorter hours, typically what is happening when an economy is achieving shorter hours of work is that it is taking some of its productivity growth in the form of more leisure time, shorter hours, rather than more output. And this is the biggest reason that economies which take economic progress in the form of shorter hours of work are foregoing a certain amount of production. Because if you think about it, the more hours we work, the more we produce, generally speaking. I mean, you know, it's more true in manufacturing, mining, logging, and so on and so forth. Service sector is a slightly different case, but so hours of work tend to be associated with production. Production is what has eco-impact. So over the long term, that's the big impact. There's another dimension to it as well, which is that households who are less time-stressed also can do things in more ecologically light ways. So it's often the most time-stressed households who have to engage in the most ecologically heavy practices, and transport's the perfect example of this. The less time you have, the more likely you are to go use the fastest forms of travel. And the faster the form of travel you use, the more polluting it is. And, you know, we could think from walking to driving or public transport, then to personal driving, and then to airplanes, which are the most damaging. So there's that dimension. And then the other dimension also has to do with sort of commuting and the use of offices and so forth. And we see cases where companies or institutions, local governments have done this, go to four-day work weeks. They're then not using that light and power on that fifth day. There's a lot less commuting going on. So those are some of the reasons why. I've got some evidence in the book about this, but in general, reductions in working hours tend to be associated with reductions in ecological footprint, other things held equal.
If you're using the reduction in hours to increase employment, though, you wouldn't necessarily be decreasing the output.
Right. Some of it you may just be trading off. So if you think about just at this moment in time, we have a certain amount of production that we're doing. If we shared it out among more people, the impact on footprint wouldn't be so large. So there's the difference in sort of what we do at a point in time and then the longer-term trajectory of the economy. And if you put an economy on a shorter hours trajectory, that's where you'll see some of those bigger reductions in footprint.
Now, one of the most exciting ideas, I think, in your book is the idea that capitalism actually doesn't need growth. All these years that I've been thinking about sustainability in business, I've thought, you know, on the one hand, we need a sustainable economy. On the other hand, how is capitalism going to transition to that? So tell us a little bit about how could business live with a world in which there were less output?
Well, you know, it's really interesting because there are a number of different ways from which to think about this. At its most abstract, it is the case that a business doesn't technically have to grow to succeed. It needs to keep its productivity growth healthy because that's the thing that's really going to determine its competitive position, how much it costs for the business to make its product at any given level of quality relative to its competitors. So how do you keep your productivity up? Well, you have a well-managed, motivated workforce on the one hand, and you keep enough of your profits each year to invest in new ways of doing things, new machinery, and so forth. Does that imply anything about how large the business has to get? One of the things I argue in the book is not necessarily. You can, of course, think about the mom-and-pop operation, which can stay at the same size for many, many years. It uses its profits to reinvest and keep up with its competitors. But why is it any different at a larger scale? We somehow just assume that it is and that bigger companies must grow. In fact, one thing we've seen is that some of these companies which pursue very high rates of growth often crash and burn because they try to grow too fast. Once a company reaches the optimal scale so that it is making its products at the least cost point, then it can actually continue, you know, at a given size for a long period of time. The place where you start to see more of a kind of growth imperative is when you have more control by finance. And this is where we've gotten into a lot of trouble in our economy with the so-called financialization. As Wall Street and other financial institutions get more power in the economy and more of our businesses are dependent on them, or they call the shots in terms of how the stock market works and so forth, the pressure for short-term growth and high profits in the short term then does lead to a situation where firms feel they have to pursue high growth strategies. But that's mostly to pay off their bankers. If we shifted back to a situation which was more common in the past, where more of our investment was done through the retained earnings of firms, in other words, they took the profits they generated and plowed them back into their businesses, then you see less pressure for the high growth rates that Wall Street is demanding. We'll have a much healthier economy, too, because financialization has been associated not with the healthy growth of many of our companies, but basically with the hollowing out of our manufacturing base, with Wall Street taking over lots of companies, running them into the ground, and then shifting production overseas. So the growth has been, short-term growth has been actually an anti-growth strategy from the long run.
You also say that there's another really critical resource to this new plenitude economy that you posit in your book, Juliet Shore, by the name Plenitude, and that is knowledge. Tell us about the new knowledge economy and how that can be used to create hybrid forms of property that coexist with capitalism.
Yeah, I think this is really important. You know, most of the debate about sustainability, particularly in the business realm, has focused on issues as sort of such as what is the price of carbon, or you know, what are the government policies around internalizing the external effects, so-called external effects in the market, or what things do we produce? You know, what sectors are we in and so forth, or what's our technology? And those are all critical factors in a sustainable economy. But the other key thing, as you start to think about the question of transition, you know, how do we get to sustainability, and what are the new kinds of production technologies that we're going to use, the issue of knowledge becomes very important. If you think about the industrial paradigm, what was scarce in the industrial economy was labor. So labor was expensive, and finance. Labor and capital are expensive. Nature was treated as free, and therefore, no surprise, the kinds of dynamics and the search to reduce costs and so forth focus on replacing labor with capital and efficient forms of getting access to capital, and that's, of course, the development of, you know, a complex financial system. Now, in a sustainable production system, what becomes scarce, the new scarce resource, is going to be nature. So what we're going to try and do is figure out how to produce in ways that preserve nature, that use far less material throughput, that create closed-loop systems, that don't create waste, that don't create toxic, we don't have toxic materials and so forth. We'll be less concerned with labor saving, in part because we have huge global surpluses of labor right now. What we want to do is get these people back to work, not create ever more capital-intensive production systems that throw more people out of work. So a new dynamic in which nature is the scarce factor means we need a whole lot more brain and knowledge power, and I call it ecological knowledge. We need dynamics which are going to dramatically increase the rate at which we develop ecological knowledge, because over the last couple of hundred years, ecological knowledge actually has been eroding as we lose sort of traditional ways of farming and doing things that are pretty efficient in terms of nature.
Juliet Shore talking about her new book, Plenitude. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We continue our conversation after the break. Don't go away. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with economist Juliet Shore about her vision for living well within our means in an economy where business as usual is no longer sustainable. Many, including President Obama, are touting a college education as necessary to succeed economically. But a college education is rapidly becoming unaffordable for many in the middle class, much less the poor. Juliet Shore says the open source knowledge available to anyone with an internet connection enables people to create a DIY education for themselves that can bring some real economic benefits. You make this link to promoting the economic health of low-income communities. In fact, you say with this kind of open source, you can help to redistribute the wealth to a more fair distribution.
Yeah, it's really interesting because if you think about why it is that we have so many poor people, a large part of it has to do with the de-skilling that's gone on among our population, and people who are poor typically don't have valuable skills that they can sell in markets. If what's happening now is a new production regime is developing, a whole new way of producing, that's a sort of, think of it as a clean, green, new production paradigm emerging, to the extent that low-income people can get access to these new forms of ecological knowledge, they then have valuable skills which they can use to contribute in that those new economies that are growing. And so some of the really interesting development organizations in the poorest communities in our country are busy teaching people how to do ecological restoration, how to create rooftop gardens, how to do solar installation, and so forth. They're teaching new forms of knowledge and skills. There are a lot of skills, particularly around self-reliance and meeting basic needs, that have atrophied in our population as we've become so focused to kind of, you know, pushing papers, as it were. And we've lost a lot of the practical skills of growing food, building houses, keeping ourselves warm, and so forth. And as we learn how to do these things in new, low-footprint ways, the people who have developed those skills will have, you know, a much easier time gaining livelihood and living in decent ways that allow them to meet their needs. One of the things I love about the new skills that are and knowledges that are emerging is that they're being passed on informal ways that don't cost a lot of money to access. So through workshops, through online stuff, through face-to-face contacts, through apprenticeship models, rather than really expensive private educations that large numbers of people can't afford. The fact that we have a technology that allows us to do this now, to spread knowledge at virtually no cost, is absolutely revolutionary. And I talk in the book about the parallels to what's going on in software, information, and culture. And for the most part, that world has not yet sort of merged with the sustainability world to figure out how it is that things like Linux and Wikipedia and all of these fantastic software products that have been produced free, you know, through a peer production model, people volunteering their time, energy, and creativity to make something for the common good and then making it freely available to people, that model will take us very far in the world of sustainability, as well as people realize they want to make a difference. They want to try and save the planet, or at least save human beings' ability to reproduce themselves on the planet. And that's what's motivating a lot of these folks.
And it's fun.
And it's fun. It's creative, it's empowering, it's autonomous. Reducing our dependence on the Exxon Mobils, the BPs, the Goldman Sachs, the Citibanks, these are institutions that have failed us. And it's time for us to just pick ourselves up and, you know, start creating a different economy. And that's what my book is about. It's about the people who are already doing that. It shows the economic explanations for why it makes sense to do this.
And the book is Plenitude, The New Economics of True Wealth. Thanks so much for talking with us, Juliet Shore.
It's been a great pleasure. I've really enjoyed it, Francesca.
Go to writersvoice.net for links to Juliet Shore's blog, where you'll find lots of examples of her vision of Plenitude. One person who's putting her vision into practice is Lyle Estill. Next up, we talk with him about his book, Small is Possible, Life in a Local Economy. Estill was a global software entrepreneur when he decided that big financial success wasn't all it was cracked up to be. He'd moved to a small town in North Carolina whose economy had been hollowed out when a local textile mill went overseas. Estill put his talents to creating a local company to provide internet service to the town. Then he helped found a cooperative venture in biofuels. He also helped create a local currency, the Plenty, which received a fair amount of press worldwide when the local bank started recognizing the Plenty as legal tender. Estill put his lessons in building a local economy into a terrific little book called Small is Possible. It's filled with stories that will warm your heart and get you thinking in a new way.
We're in Chatham County, North Carolina, which is just outside of the Research Triangle Park of Chapel Hill, Raleigh, and Durham. So at the focal point is Pittsboro, North Carolina, which is a small southern town of 2,500 souls.
And, wow, that is pretty small, actually, even by small town standards. What's the economic base of this small area?
Well, I would say that we are probably agriculture, and we are golf courses, and we are sort of a bedroom community for the Research Triangle Park. I guess from a traditional economic development perspective, you would say it's a depleted part of the land, which is actually the reason I wrote the book, was to try to refocus on those things that we're doing that are working and are vibrant and are providing vitality to our economy.
So depleted part of the land, that doesn't describe the agricultural soil.
Okay, so our soils, our agriculture is in a very tough spot right now. So 300-acre family farms on the edge of a growing population center, the Research Triangle Park. The pressure is this: too large to reinvent yourself into a market garden or a sustainable, small-scale sustainable farm, and yet too small to play in global commodity markets. And so our farms tend to be right in the middle, and that means probably your best bet is to become a golf course community and throw a fork in it.
You were first entrenched in the global economy yourself. Tell us how you started out in the business world.
Yeah, I was. I bought into the whole line that, you know, if you're not global, then you're not really in the game, back in the 80s and 90s. And so I did some globetrotting, and I ran around selling my wares. I was in computer widgets and software and so on. I've been an entrepreneur for a long time. And really, my family business was a global computer company that I built with my brothers. And I did that, and really, you know, I moved to Chatham County, North Carolina in 1990 and started learning about community and started wanting to be closer to home and started moving my businesses into town and closer and trying to get out of commuting. I guess the book is an exploration of the small businesses that I've traveled through over the years since then and what it would take for our community to feed itself and fuel itself and finance itself, etc.
Estill says the more power you give away, the more you have. It's not about competition in a world of scarcity, but cooperation in a world of abundance. That sounds a lot like Juliet Shore's Plenitude. He's putting the idea into practice in the biofuels company he helped to start, Piedmont Biofuels. It's the largest biodiesel co-op in America.
It's all about start point. So what is your start point? If you go through the business as usual world, dog eat dog, the start point is that everything is scarce and I have to compete for my share. And this is true of everything. This is true of attention and love and sex and money and everything that you have in your life. It's hard to get and you need to go claw your way to get it. And if that's your start point, and you go out and behave that way, so I'm going to take from you and you and you to meet my needs. The opposite of that is abundance, and the opposite of that is my start point is I get everything I want or something better all the time, which means I absolutely don't have to step on the guy on the rung below me because I get everything I want or something better all the time. the whole world works for me. And if that's my start point going through life, and I do create my world that way, absolutely. And it's also true down here at Piedmont Biofuels. What have we done? We started making biodiesel in the backyard. We became a co-op. The co-op became the largest biodiesel co-op in America. We went on to commercial production. The commercial production has got a vibrant consulting business right now. I have visitors from all over Canada and the United States. I accidentally became a foremost authority on biodiesel production, as did all of my people. On any given day of the week, you will find somebody at Piedmont Biofuels as a paid consulting gig. We're now up to $200 an hour to sit around and talk about maybe regulations or technology or chemical reactions or some element of biodiesel. And we got there by assuming that we're going to get everything we want or something better. We didn't get there by saying, okay, I figured that out. Now I'm going to keep it a secret. Now I'm going to go get a patent on it. And 2 years later, I'm going to have something that I can, you know, sell for $1 million as I spend all of my time, you know, protecting my secret.
I first heard about Lyle Estill because of the local currency he was involved in creating. It's called the Plenty.
In the chapter of Small as Possible called Financing Ourselves, I did two things. The first is I accidentally wrote about our locally owned bank, which is called Capital Bank. And when the book came out, it sold well in our town. And people started reading it, and they started thinking, wow, you know, I could know my banker, and I don't want to be with the big global bank. So they would close their account on one side of town and go down and open their account at Capital Bank. So the people who thought about buying local and plugging into the local economy read the book and said, good idea, I'm going to go change my banking habits. All right, so that causes the bank to say, you know, what's this book that we keep hearing about? So I took him a copy of Small as Possible, and the next thing you know, the founder of the bank is at my door, and he needs a box of books to give to his friends because he's in the book. And the next thing you know, I'm doing a Small as Possible reading for his wife's book club down in Sanford. And, you know, on and on. I accidentally became the darling of Capital Bank. They're seeing their deposits go up. And by the way, this is before the current economic meltdown that we've experienced since then. So here we are. The other thing I talked about in the chapter Financing Ourselves is the Plenty. And the Plenty was started in 2002 by a group of local activists in Carrboro, North Carolina. And they had a vision of following some of the other great local currencies in the world. I think there's one in Ithaca, New York, called the Ithaca Hour, and there's one in the Berkshires called the Berkshire, operated by the E.F. Schumacher Society. And they basically came out with a local currency. And the concept behind the local currency is the circulation, the monetary circulation, stays in your community. So they got it launched, and they got a bunch of people accepting plenties, and I'm merely telling the story in the book that this is what happened. And, of course, one of the things that happened is the currency circulated, but the people behind it, the volunteers, the passionate people who got it launched, ran out of steam. And the project, you know, people fall in love, right? People move away. People go back to graduate school. People's lives change. And the, you know, pretty soon the board of directors is gone and the website is no longer working and there's no phone number to join up to take plenties. But the plenty is still circulating. And that is, people are still accepting it and it's still going round and round. So what happened is a politician, B.J. Lawson, read about the plenty in Small as Possible. And he comes down to Pittsburgh to use on the campaign trail, and he does a video blog about Piedmont Biofuels. And we got to be friends and intrigued with one another's thinking. And so B.J. Lawson, after the campaign, really has started a effort to revitalize the plenty. And what's interesting is, you know, we're just sitting around at lunch one day, and one guy's like, well, I could use it to pay my interns. And another person's like, well, I could do the website. And my thing is, you know, I'll bet I could get a bank to take it. And basically, we all went out and did just that. Having a bank accepting the local currency for exchange to U.S. dollars is pivotal in that it removes the circulatory block. So in the first round of plenties, Plenty 1.0, we'll call it, there was a threat that you'd get stuck with them all. So you'd make a, you're an artist and you'd sell a big sculpture and you get a big wad of plenties and it's going to take you a year to convert those into lunches at the general store cafe. And getting stuck with them all caused people to, well, actually go to the city in the sense that they'd say, uh-oh, I can't accept a full plenty for your lunch. I can only accept half your half a lunch worth in plenties and so on. Having a bank alleviates that problem. Anytime you feel like you have too many plenties in your pocket, you go down to the bank and you exchange them for U.S. dollars. And that was the critical part of the Plenty relaunch of Plenty 2.0. And essentially, that's how you heard about it. The reason you heard about it was because local bank accepts local currency became international news as we go deeper into this depression. So the next thing we knew, you know, Fox is in town, and CNN's been to town twice, and now, you know, NBC's rolling, and we're on Polish television and Russian television, and it's been a wild media ride. So I think the role that Small as Possible played is it might have, you know, tweaked the interest of the bank, maybe plowed the soil, if you will, and it tweaked the interest of B.J. Lawson, and all of those things sort of came together, and the Plenty relaunch is on. So it is going. It's adding new members every day, and new currency has been printed. They changed the denominations, and it actually has a paid executive director at this point. So Melissa Fry now is able to go door to door and educate merchants and you know sell memberships in the Plenty.
We're talking with Lyle Estill about Small as Possible. It's about how to create a thriving local economy like the one in North Carolina where he lives. Two questions. One, is it the only local currency that has a bank backing it? And then two, what's in it for the bank?
The bank has received a terrific amount of publicity. So if you are accepting the plenty at your local business and you are, you know, trading them in every night as part of your, you know, managing the till, you say, gosh, I'll just take my move my account over to Capital Bank because that way I can have one stop instead of two. So the bank is seeing their deposits go up. From the bank's perspective, it's probably also just really a marketing thing in that people say, wow, I like the local currency. It feels good to me. I like using it. And, oh, there's the bank that's involved, so I like that bank too. And essentially that's kind of the game. The game is that the local feed store is accepting plenties, and you know I need a bag of bird seed for my bird feeder at home. I've got a pocket full of plenties. I say, well, I'll just pick up my bird seed here where I didn't usually get it. I usually got all my bird seed at the big box store on the edge of town, but they don't take plenty, so I'll get my bird seed from the guy that does. That's sort of the principle. Is it the only bank to accept a local currency? I'm going to say no, and I'm also going to say I don't know the answer to that. I think that a study out of Cornell University of the Ithaca Hour, they were able to measure an increase in the standard of living in Ithaca, New York, as the result of the circulation of the hour. And I could be wrong about this, but I believe a local credit union in Ithaca was involved in exchanging hours, Ithaca hours. Up in the Berkshires, the Berkshire has a circulation of something like $750,000 worth of local currency circulating. And that's a lot of money. I would say that probably there's a financial institution somewhere in that $750,000 circulation that keeps it going.
And so the key here in terms of local economic well-being going up is that the multiplier effect is a lot larger with a local currency, that it's this, any one of these denominations is going to be passed around more often locally than a dollar would.
It's completely right. So one of the measures of the health of an economy is how many times that dollar goes around town before it leaves. And so Michael Schumann, who's a great author about local economy, uses the example of the local bookstore. And in his example, he says, you know, let's say you go buy a book from the local bookstore. Chances are really good they're going to take a portion of the proceeds and use that for the local bookkeeper, chances are really good they're going to buy ads in the local newspaper for readings or specials and so on. And so that dollar is going to go from the consumer to the store to the bookkeeper to the newspaper, and the newspaper is going to pay their reporter who's going to go out to eat. And at some point, that dollar is going to leave town. But it might cross hands 5 times or 7 times or 10 times. Compare that to buying a book from Amazon. You go buy the book from Amazon, your dollar leaves town immediately, never to be seen or heard of again.
Lyle Estill, in your book, Small as Possible, Life in a Local Economy, you're pretty honest about some of the difficulties. It isn't all a bed of roses. There, by and large, are success stories, but sometimes there's a bumpy road to success. You talk about the local food co-op, the Chatham Marketplace, and you wrote an article in a local paper saying that providing a local marketplace in a global economy is an exceedingly difficult thing to do. And you point out that people will tend to shop where it's cheaper. And I'd like to say probably in the current recession, that kind of pressure for going for the price point is going to be even more intense than when people are feeling flush. So what are the lessons that you derive from the story of the Chatham Marketplace?
Right. Okay, so it's a really good point. And Chatham Marketplace, by the way, is doing very well. But it's true, if we back up a minute and say, what is the fundamental underpinning of our economy? And we say, well, that is that everybody is a rational actor. Everybody is going to do what is in their personal best interest. And if your best interest is to save a dollar, then you always will save a dollar. And one of the things that I question is, really, maybe it's in your personal best interest to have a co-op grocery store that has the organic food that you want. And maybe that means that instead of saving a dollar, you're spending more money than you normally would. And in fact, maybe spending more money on locally produced goods and services really is in your best interest. I think it's a completely legitimate argument that says, actually, paying a little bit more for your fuel that's made from the local biodiesel plant may be in your better interest than, say, getting the cheap stuff out of the Middle East.
And how is that?
It's because something like fuel or food have externalized their true costs. Let's stick to fuel for a second, because that's the easy one. When you buy a gallon of fuel at the pump and you pay, say, $2 for it, not included in that $2 is the price of health care associated with using that product. So everywhere on Earth where the government is involved in the health care of its people, fuel is more expensive. Even in Canada, which is a net exporter of petroleum, fuel is more expensive. Why? Because someone has to pay for the asthma and the respiratory problems caused with the use of that product. So let's pretend that you had to pay for health care at the pump for the use of that product at a buck. You're now at $3 for that gallon of fuel. And then let's talk about security for a moment. Even in peacetime, the United States maintains a massive military presence in the Persian Gulf, and we have fighter jet escorts for supertankers going through the Strait of Hormuz. And that's not paid for by Exxon. That's paid for on April 15th when you mail in your check to Uncle Sam. And we could just keep going. Let's go for climate change for a moment. Down here in North Carolina, we're seeing our insurance premiums are rising on the coast, 30% last year. Why are we paying 30% more for property insurance? Oh, well, because the storms are getting worse, and the storms are getting more frequent because of climate change. So we pay for the cost of that gallon of fuel when we send in our check to our health care insurance company. We pay for the cost when we send in our check to Uncle Sam, and we pay for the cost when we send in our check to the property insurer. So at a buck, suddenly that $2 product is a $5 product. The point is that petroleum has done such a good job of externalizing its cost, it may be in your best interest to buy a gallon of my locally made biodiesel for a little more than the pump and take into account all those true costs.
Well, I'm going to press you a little bit on this because I think all your points are well taken, and I'm personally in complete agreement with them. But I can still hear somebody say, yeah, but if I pay for the biodiesel, I still got to pay those taxes. I still got to pay for the health insurance. It's not going to make a difference. And meanwhile, I'm out the extra buck or two that it costs to pay for the biodiesel, and I'm hurting right now. So I really need to go and, you know, buy at Walmart or buy at the local Sitco station and not get it from you. How can we begin to put the money right back into people's pockets so that the transition is made a little bit more easy for people who really don't have that extra discretionary income to spend?
No, it's a good point, and it's a complicated point. Okay, so why do people spend more on, say, biodiesel or organic food or some such? The issue is that, what is it? The issue is that we stand in the face of incomprehensibly complex problems. So what can you do about climate change? It might be nothing. And since you can do nothing about climate change, or say war, or, you know, global resource depletion, pick one, the individual looks at these things and thinks, there's nothing I can do. Part of the thrust of Small as Possible is there is something you can do. You can get off the petroleum grid and run around on biodiesel. You can get off the petroleum grid and eat locally grown food. And there is a value to doing that. Now, I guess if your argument is, well, I don't have the extra dollar, so I'm just all Walmart all the time, the idea is, you know, the dislocation is coming. The dislocation is here. We're seeing it. Business as usual has got us into this mess. So back to Chatham Marketplace for a moment. They are an anchor tenant in our abandoned textile mill. So the notion of the global economy is what cost us our mill. That is, save a buck, move it to Malaysia. That's why our mill is empty. That's why our mill town is, you know, was wiped out. Because all that matters is that we save a dollar, send the mill to Indonesia, and have the kids weave the fabrics for us, because you only have to pay them a nickel, where over here you had to pay someone a dime. Well, okay, so the cost then is we have an empty mill. The global economy cost us our mill, and it's local businesses that are bringing it back. A mill on the edge of town with a parking lot full of cars from people shopping at Chatham Marketplace is actually energetically a good thing for this town. And the notion of, well, I'm going to drive on by and save my money down at Walmart might not really be in your best interest.
Lyle Estille, your book is Small as Possible, Life in a Local Economy. I highly recommend this book. It's a terrific read and lots of wonderful stories in it. Thanks so much for talking with us.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
You can find out more about the Plenty and Piedmont Biofuels at writersvoice.net. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net for more about today's shows. You'll find links to more information, web-only features, and you can sign up for our podcast and get connected on Twitter and Facebook. Thanks for listening. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.